terms. As you all know, he's currently the director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown, and also associate dean of the Foreign Service School there. Insofar as the Carter administration was concerned, I suppose one would say that the highest position he held was Undersecretary for Political Affairs in the Carter administration. Dave Newsom is almost a native Virginian. He was born in Richmond, California.
And he received quite different from Richmond.
He received his AB in political his AB at the University of California and his master's at Columbia. Early in his career, he held the Pulitzer Traveling Scholar and then became publisher of the Walnut Creek, California Courier Journal. And this is the part that David and especially perhaps Michael want to listen to. He rose in rank from third secretary and information officer in the American Embassy in Karachi, assumed the post of second secretary and vice consul in the embassy at Oslo, Norway, was public affairs officer in Baghdad, Iraq, then officer in charge of the Arabian Peninsula affairs in the Department of State, then first secretary of the American Embassy in London, and then deputy director of the Office of North African Affairs in the State Department. And at that point, Michael, he became ready for higher responsibilities, even than the ones I've recited, but he had to earn it. He was U.S. ambassador to Libya, then a second assistant secretary of state for African affairs, then U.S. ambassador to Indonesia, then a U.S. ambassador to the Philippines, then undersecretary, as I've indicated, for political affairs. In addition, he was special advisor to the U.S. delegation of the U.N. General Assembly in 72, 78, 79, and 80. Served in World War II to the rank of lieutenant in the U.S. Navy. He received numerous awards for his public service, among them the Meritorious Service Award from the Department of State, the National Civil Service League Award, and the Rockefeller Public Service Awards. I sat in on one or two of the selection committees, although I had no official role, of the Rockefeller Public Service Awards, and I can assure you that that's one of the stiffest and sternest evaluations that I can ever remember hearing as they talked about the people that should receive the award. In any case, we have had some discussion on foreign policy in the Carter administration, including discussion by both the President and the First Lady, but it seems to me that it's high time we had some more, and no one is better qualified to lead us in talking about this subject than Dave Newsom. Incidentally, after that long recitation about who gained what good things from Dave Newsom, I should tell you that he has, in this present semester, been a visiting professor at the University of Virginia. So it's a great pleasure to have you, Dave.
Well, Ken, thank you very much. And I appreciate all this background. I hope I can live up to some of it. This is a completely unrehearsed and unprepared presentation. I was just handed this set of questions as I walked in the door this morning. But in public life, one does get used to the being suddenly presented with questions and problems. So This is taking me back to periods before congressional committees and other such adventures. Let me start with the last question on this sheet and work forward. Really the last two questions. How would you assess the record of the Carter presidency? How would you compare it with other presidencies? And how do you think future historians will judge the Carter presidency? How do you judge it? As my record indicates, I have worked under, I think, seven different presidents, but in the earlier years it was at greater distance from the presidency than it was in later years. But I did get a sense of the Eisenhower administration. I was in the Office of Near Eastern Affairs during two major crises of the Eisenhower administration, the Suez Crisis and the Lebanese Crisis of 58. And at that time, the State Department was was smaller, and those of relatively junior rank had the opportunity to work directly with the Secretary of State during crisis periods. So there is that comparison. There is my brief recollection of the Kennedy administration. I was overseas during much of the Johnson administration, and then worked as an assistant secretary in the first Nixon administration. So I can, I think, make a suitable claim to a certain non-alignment politically and from the standpoint of experience. I would say two things in general about the Carter administration. Incidentally, I came in after the first year of the administration. I was ambassador in the Philippines when Philip Habib, who was the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, had a heart attack, and then I received a phone call while sitting comfortably in our veranda in Manila one morning saying, "Would you please come back to Washington?" And just when I was getting used to the view of Manila Bay, I was thrust back into the Washington scene in April of 1978. I stayed through the administration. I was the Secretary of State ad interim between the two administrations, and I was down here some years ago talking about transitions. So that was the span of the Carter presidency that I saw. The Undersecretary for Political Affairs is used in different ways by different secretaries of state and by different administrations. In my case, I became a kind of utility infielder on the seventh floor, picking up issues that Cyrus Vance and then later Edmund Muskie, the secretaries, were unable to deal with, or Warren Christopher, the deputy secretary, and therefore my agenda was a very wide one, and it's from that experience that I make these assessments. My first impression is that the Carter administration accomplished a great deal, but the accomplishments were never really perceived in the perhaps the full dimensions that they deserved, because everyone had a political handicap domestically. this fact was complicated by a feeling which is probably justified, but maybe at the same time explicable, that President Carter tried to do too many things at once, placing burdens on the political system which it was probably not totally able to bear. But if you look at what was accomplished during the Carter administration, some by direct U.S. intervention, some by U.S. assistance to others in bringing about accomplishments. The record, I think, was impressive. The negotiation of the Panama Canal Treaty was completed, and with tremendous effort, the administration got it ratified by the Senate. People look back, I know, with different views on the Panama Canal Treaty, and yet I think if you look back at the last 10 years, our relations with Latin America, as troubled as they have been, would have been a lot more troubled if we had not settled, from the Latin American standpoint, the Panama Canal issue. Camp David was a tremendous diplomatic accomplishment. If anyone had predicted a year before the Camp David agreement, which brought Israel and Egypt together in a peace treaty, that a peace treaty between these two antagonists would be possible, they would have been discredited just as someone might have been 2 years ago who predicted the disintegration of the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe. The United States worked assiduously with the British to help bring about the resolution of the Zimbabwe-Rhodesian issue, which was a major problem for the United States in Africa until that time. Sometimes we look back at these issues and we say, yes, but there are still unresolved aspects. The Panama Canal Treaty didn't solve the problem of Panama. The Camp David Agreement didn't solve the problem of the Palestinians. The Rhodesian settlement didn't solve other problems in southern Africa. But I think one has to look at how much farther forward each of these settlements moved the the strategic and political circumstances in each of these regions. The Carter administration played a major role in bringing about the UN resolution that later became the foundation for Chester Crocker's successful negotiation of a of an accord on the independence of Namibia. The SALT agreement, the negotiation was completed on SALT II, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. But the the load placed on the Congress, and particularly on senators who had serious conservative opposition in their districts, by putting both the Panama Canal and SALT into the Senate at the same time, was probably more than the political traffic could bear. Much criticism in retrospect has been made of the Carter emphasis on human rights. I think that there's one aspect of this that has never been fully appreciated. Certainly President Carter himself had a strong dedication to the human rights element in the American diplomatic agenda. But he was building on a whole series of legislative acts that placed a requirement on any administration, as the Reagan administration subsequently found, to emphasize human rights in the conduct of our diplomacy. The emphasis was greater in the Carter administration because of the existence of the legislation, because a number of the staff members who had worked on the Hill in bringing about this legislation and were strong advocates of human rights in our diplomacy moved to the State Department, to the Bureau of Humanitarian Affairs from the Hill, and gave an added impetus. But the key is one that I think I've never really seen referred to. The man that really administered the application of human rights to our diplomacy at that time was Warren Christopher, the Deputy Secretary of State, who headed a committee that reviewed our relations with other countries in the light of the requirements placed on the administration by the legislation. And if any of you know Warren, he is a dedicated lawyer who feels very deeply about the responsibilities of an administration to reflect the will of the Congress as expressed in legislation. And that was a significant element in the development of human rights policies. One can say that it was inconsistent because inevitably one has to balance a number of different considerations in the conduct of foreign policy, strategic, political, economic, and it is never a perfect outcome. But if one visits a number of countries today, Argentina being one, there are many, many people who will speak with gratitude of the emphasis that the Carter administration put on this particular aspect of our diplomacy. Now, these were the positive aspects. Of course, the principal negative that everyone thinks about is the Iran hostage crisis. I was very actively involved in that, and I think a case could be made that even that, in a sense, was a positive outcome, although it was not possible to recognize it as such in the political atmosphere that surrounded it. The hostages were taken in the midst of an Iranian revolution. We were told by those who knew Khomeini and knew Iran fairly early on in the crisis that we were unlikely to resolve the crisis until Khomeini had put into place the institutions of his new constitution so that he could then transfer to them the responsibility for the hard decisions on the release of the hostages. And in effect, that was what happened. It was only after the new parliament was elected that Khomeini sent his 4 points that ultimately formed the basis for the decision to negotiate the release of the hostages. And I think so much of what the administration did in the early months of 1980 was basically wheel spinning, because we never reached through to the source of power. namely to Khomeini himself, until he felt that he could provide a facade for his decisions through the parliament and other institutions that he had created. And I think if it illustrates anything, I mean, Carter has been criticized, and perhaps justifiably so, for identifying himself so much with this issue. It is a delicate decision for any president to decide when and to what extent to identify himself with perhaps controversial and maybe losing political issues. Carter chose to identify himself with this, and I think suffered politically as a result. But the hostages were ultimately released. The negotiation was not, as some in the new administration, the Reagan administration, thought, a negotiation over a ransom. It was a negotiation over the disposition of Iranian assets. And in a quite a remarkable outcome, not only did we get the hostages released, but we also set aside a very substantial amount of the frozen Iranian assets to pay off American claims. And the tribunal that has been set up for that has worked astonishingly well in the intervening years. So, I think history will look back and judge the Carter administration as one that made a number of positive contributions, changing the face of politics and strategy in the Middle East and in Southern Africa. Now, the key difficulty in the Carter administration, as I observed it, and this is not unique to the Carter administration, was that the president was never willing on certain very significant issues to come down firmly in a decision that involved his making a choice between and among his advisors. He relied very heavily on Dr. Brzezinski. Dr. Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor, had some very decided views about what U.S. policy toward the Soviets should be, not only with respect to bilateral relations with the Soviets, but with respect to activities in the Third World as well. Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State, had somewhat different views. He was more in favor of trying to negotiate issues than he was in trying to create what we, at least in the State Department, occasionally saw as confrontation. But the administration throughout the period I was acquainted with it was never able on certain of these key issues, particularly the issues relating to the East-West confrontation, to speak with one voice. And this had its impact both in the terms of the degree of support domestically and in Congress, and it certainly had its impact in the relations with the Allies. Such disasters as the neutron bomb incident, in which President Carter, after his administration had given a number of signals suggesting that the United States was going ahead with the production of this enhanced radiation weapon, suddenly at the last minute, and to the great distress, if not consternation, of Chancellor Schmidt of Germany, decided not to go forward with it. There was the famous case of the Annapolis speech on East-West issues, in which President Carter took two drafts to Camp David, a State Department draft and an NSC draft, and literally cut and paste, put them together so that the decision with respect to, or the message with respect to our policy on East-West relations came out somewhat blurred. I can cite one incident to illustrate the problem. After Secretary Muskie took office, we all went up to Camp David for a kind of hands-on session with the new Secretary of State. The Secretary and I guess three or four of us from the State Department, Dr. Brzezinski, David Aaron, Jody Carter, Jody Powell, Pam Jordan, the President. And the President said to Secretary Muskie, "Now, Ed, I want you to be the voice of the United States on foreign policy issues. I want you to I want to be sure that we it's very clear that you are the one that will articulate the decisions on foreign policy of this administration." Everyone, or at least on our side of the table, I guess, felt, well, now we're really making some progress. And then at the very end of the meeting, Carter turned to Brzezinski and said, "Now, there will, of course, be times when I'll want Spig to speak out on some issues that are of particular importance to me." And that, of course, destroyed the whole certainty of the message that the President had delivered at the beginning. But as I say, I have seen other presidents similarly reluctant to make choices among advisors, and by making choices among advisors, making choices, hard choices on issues. Just one more. I'm sort of moving up the line on these questions. one comment I once heard one of his close advisors make on President Carter was that he never fully understood the Congress, that he thought he was still dealing with the Georgia legislature, and that the way he dealt with the Georgia legislature was, in order to spur them into action, he would throw a kind of legislative or verbal hand grenade in the middle of the Georgia legislature to stimulate them to action. And he thought he could deal with the Congress by constantly lobbing grenades into the Congress. That's perhaps an extreme expression, but I think there's a certain amount of truth in it. His view is that I seem to sense with the Congress was that you dealt with the Congress by constantly stimulating them to action through politically, through throwing politically difficult propositions into their midst. And Congress doesn't always react positively to that kind of approach. I think I'll stop there, Ken, and maybe I've thrown out enough for food for questions and thought.
I wonder if I could ask the first question, David. One of your predecessors in this series made the comment that the, in a sense, the Brzezinski-Vance problem was even broader. And he put forward the theory that Carter never took control of the bureaucracy, that he had campaigned on an anti-government platform, and when he came in, he never saw the importance of really mastering the relationship with the bureaucracy, and the American people in a succession of crises perceived that. And in the end, his summation of the Carter administration was that it had been a spectacular foreign policy success, but a domestic political disaster.
Well, I agree with that last statement. As I said at the beginning, I think each one of these accomplishments was either by their nature difficult to sell domestically, or perhaps by the way they were handled, or by the accumulation of a number of highly sensitive political issues which required politicians to make decisions. He overloaded the circuit. There's an interesting book, which one of the hundreds which Ken Thompson seems to produce out of this center, which I participated, called The President, Congress, and Foreign Policy. This the one that we did with Muskie and Rush and so forth. And during the course of the working groups in which put this book together, I had an interesting exchange with Jim Schlesinger on whether cabinet members are part of the bureaucracy or part of the executive. My observation has been that cabinet members generally tend to get captured by the departments that they represent. I sometimes, having sitting in the Situation Room in the White House through different administrations, you don't really need to look at the faces of the participants, you only need to look at the departments that they represent, and they say about the same thing whether they're in a Republican or a Democratic administration, because they're representing a bureaucratic institution. And it is not long before they're reflecting the views of that institution more than they are the views of perhaps of the president. In the present administration, I think that's one thing that Jim Baker has been very conscious of, and why he's had the kind of problems with the State Department that he's had, but that's incidental. I think, in answer to your question, I think that the bureaucracy was well represented in the Carter administration, because in general the secretaries of the relevant departments with the possible exception of Harold Brown, really became advocates for their particular department. So that Carter was dealing constantly with the reflections of the bureaucracy through his the members of his cabinet, and was certainly not unaware of the presence, the views, the impact. Was not necessarily prepared to listen to those bureaucratic views if they seemed to go contrary either to the NSC view or to the perception of the political climate that was given to him by Pam Jordan and others. But I don't know of a single president that I have worked with who has felt comfortable with the bureaucracy. And another thing that might be said about the Carter administration, and it applies to the Reagan administration also, I would suggest that the Carter administration was the first ideological administration since the Eisenhower administration, in the sense that it came into office with a lot of new people who had not previously served in Washington in government, who had some very firm ideas about the direction that the nation should go, ideological in character as they applied, particularly in the human rights field, there is, when you have people coming into office who have not previously worked in Washington or been a part of the policy process at a high level, and who have come from a highly ideological political campaign, there is a built-in tension that almost never disappears with the bureaucracy, because it was true in the Reagan years too. It was true when Eisenhower came in after the long Democratic period, Roosevelt, Truman, with the attitude, well, who are these people? They weren't with us in the campaign. They were strong supporters of the policies of the last administration, which we opposed in the campaign. How can we trust them? There is that natural tension, compounded, I think, in the Carter years by the number of people who came in with agendas of their own, which they saw as different from the bureaucratic agenda.
Questions from any, including the graduate students. Michael, you've probably all your life wanted to ask an undersecretary a question.
I wanted to ask if Ronald Reagan and Jean Kirkpatrick and their supporters during this decade, during the 1980s, always have asserted that President Carter put far too much emphasis on human rights to the detriment of economic and even political development in Latin America. And I never found there to be a great difference between emphasis for human rights and political rights in that area of the world. I was wondering if you could maybe articulate how President Carter saw the relationship between his emphasis on human rights and the need to promote democracy.
If I were to draw a distinction between the two administrations, I think the the emphasis in the Carter years was basically not so much institutional as it was human, in the sense the emphasis was on how other governments treated their citizens. So the emphasis was on issues of detention without trial, torture, the disappearances, political prisoners. There was a continuing debate in the Carter administration over the extent to which you could or could not separate these issues of basic rights to life and liberty from the institutional, from the creation of democratic institutions which more adequately protect these rights. But there was a reluctance on the part of many in the Carter administration to move from a interventions with other governments on individual cases and group cases of how they treated their publics to demands for radical reform in the political and legal structures. Now, the evolution of human rights in the Reagan administration is a very interesting story. When the first transition team came in after the election, one of their main objectives was to abolish the position of Assistant Secretary for Humanitarian Affairs and to de-emphasize human rights. One finds in the transition period how astonishingly ignorant are some of those coming into office are of the realities of life in Washington. And one of the realities was that the position of Assistant Secretary for Humanitarian Affairs is a congressionally mandated position which cannot be abolished by an administration. I had to acquaint the new administration with that fact. So given that, what did they do? They sent up to a then Republican-dominated Senate a candidate for the position who was known as strongly opposed to the human rights emphasis in foreign policy, namely Ernie Lefevre, who was rejected by the Senate. And I think that sent a message to the Reagan administration that they could not de-emphasize the emphasis on human rights. And Ellie Abrams came in as Assistant Secretary for Humanitarian Affairs before he moved to Latin America, and actually did a very credible job. And many of the things that he did or the administration did at that time were not greatly different from what the Carter administration had been doing before. One thing that is mandated on the administration by the Congress, which keeps people's feet to the fire on the issue in any administration, is the requirement for the annual country reports on human rights, which have to be credible to the Congress and to the various advocacy groups. So more and more the Reagan administration realized that they too had to emphasize human rights. The distinction that Gene Kirkpatrick drew, I think, became more and more indistinct as time went on. But there were two different emphases in the Reagan administration. One was that there was a much greater emphasis on human rights in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, as distinct from human rights problems in the Third World. Not that the other were neglected, but I think more effort was put on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. And there was a new emphasis that gradually developed on democratic institutions with the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy and the strong support given to it by the administration. The Reagan administration really moved into that area, which had been debatable in the Carter administration. Other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Sorensen.
Hi, how are you?
I didn't see you. May I ask two questions?
Sure.
First one has to do with this ambivalence of Jimmy Carter. But I'm thick-headed, I'm puzzled about it. Some presidents have deliberately set one advisor against another. Was this primarily an ideological matter? Was it primarily a temperamental matter? Did he go one way and then the other way? Was it deliberate? Did he realize he was doing it? That's my first question. My second question has to do with former President Jimmy Carter. He seems to be the best ex-president we ever had. He's not playing golf or making $2 million fees speeches. He's going out and doing things. Does the State Department feel that he's meddling in his post-presidential activity?
I can't answer the first question from the question about Carter's ambivalence toward his advisors, because I really don't know the answer. I think that whether this was conscious on Carter's part or not, I think he probably realized that one of his vulnerabilities was his view of the Soviet Union, which basically was a softer view than that of Brzezinski, and his recognition that he needed the, if you will, the stiffening advice of Brzezinski to or keep him in balance on that issue, because given the underlying emphasis on that issue put in this country, he realized it was politically important to maintain that degree of balance. And I'm sure that Spig reminded him of that periodically. And I think there was a closer personal relationship with Brzezinski than there was with Vance. I never had the feeling that those two men were very close. They had not known each other before, so I think it was an easier relationship with Brzezinski. There was a genuine coolness during the Reagan administration toward Carter and toward his activities, but that has changed markedly in the Bush administration, that
he he briefs the Bush administration on his activities. He keeps our embassies advised abroad, always making clear to everyone that he's doing this as an American citizen, not as someone mandated by the administration to undertake what he's doing. So I think that he was just in Washington last week, meeting with people in the administration on the after his most recent trip to the Middle East. So I think it's a good relationship now, is my impression.
Dave, can I push you just a little bit on this whole business of the triangular relationship? We spent 10 hours with him in Plains in the oral history we did, and Dick Neustadt and several went along, and this really was the main topic of discussion.
Did you get an answer?
No. Just to complicate it a little further, he said that he felt closer to Vance than he did to Brzezinski. He was more his style. He personally liked Gay and Cyrus, but first of all, the press had greatly magnified the split, and it was partly a media event. He wouldn't admit that it, and he got irritated that we were making so much of it. And secondly, he said that the main reason he used the two was that Vance never wanted to go public. Vance would not take on the talk shows. And Vance, when we interviewed him, said, well, there's an element of truth to that. And he said Brzezinski never said anything on television that ran counter to his policies. But he simply would not budge, and he has not budged since on this point that beginning with the selection, this is why it's such a mystery, beginning with the selection of Warnicke and Nitze. Remember, he's asked, who are your foreign policy advisors? And he said, the two Pauls. And that illustrated exactly what you've said. He wanted to cover both flanks. Then into this period, he'll admit none of it. So far as I can tell, none of it as any example of leading to a problem or in having inherent in it a contradiction in any way.
Well, certainly if you've interviewed all the principals, Brzezinski gave us 1 hour, or a little less than that. Well, you can read his book, I think, and get some impression of... Brzezinski, as he's written in his book, considers me wimpish anyway, so we have a reasonable relationship, but I can only add the perception of someone who has seen both men in action relatively closely during that administration, the president somewhat more distantly. And I'm not sure whether everyone will appreciate these comments, but then that's not why I'm here. Ambition and ego play a major role in any mix of figures around the president. Just the fact that many people, not all, grasp for higher office is often an indication of a driving ambition, and along with that goes a certain amount of ego, and also a sometimes a clear consciousness of a role model either to be followed or to be avoided from the past. And I've often thought that an interesting book could be written on the shadow of Henry Kissinger in foreign policy. And I sometimes sat in the Situation Room with Zweig and had the feeling that in his mind he was thinking, well, now what would Henry Kissinger have done in this particular situation? And I certainly don't want to appear any less astute in my handling of this than Henry appeared, or might have appeared. So you had in the Brzezinski-Carter, Brzezinski-Vance relationship, you had one man who was intensely ambitious, intensely conscious of how he was going to appear both within the government and outside the government. And it was very hard to disentangle the Brzezinski that was taking positions that he was because he was concerned over the political health of his president, and the Brzezinski that was taking the stands he was because he was concerned about the political health of Brzezinski. I don't know that you can ever totally disentangle that kind of a situation. Now, presidents are often either unaware or callous toward the relationships among their immediate advisors. I lived through the first Nixon administration with the just incredibly brutal treatment, I can't think of any other word, that William Rogers, as Secretary of State, got from Richard Nixon. The gradual rise of Henry Kissinger to a position of preeminence. I never had a clue as to whether that was calculated on Nixon's part, whether he was aware of how his subordinates in his name were treating Rogers. Perhaps he was more aware maybe than Carter was, but there, and maybe, I mean, all three of the men involved basically probably want to avoid exacerbating the historical image of a of deep personal divisions, but the personal divisions were there, they continued on in the Muskie period. Before Muskie came up to be Secretary of State, I had always heard of his temper. And the first time I saw it displayed was very shortly after he came into office. He was to give his first major speech on East-West relations. And that was to be given in the evening, I think. And we were all sitting with him in his office at about 5 o'clock, and in comes an aide with an AP ticker. Brzezinski had just given a backgrounder to the press on what Muskie was really going to mean when he gave his speech.
So there was this desire on Brzezinski's part to be sure that the view of the administration as it was projected by any of its members fitted with Brzezinski's view of the issues. I can't speak for Cyrus Vance, but I think any of us who were closely associated with him during that period certainly had an impression that he found the president something of an enigma. And that his resignation was not solely over the desert rescue effort, but was really the accumulation of, I think, of a growing feeling that he was less and less able to get through to the president and to get his ideas accepted.
Could I just ask one last one? If all of this is true and the evidence from everybody we've talked to is overwhelming that it is, why were the policies so successful?
The area where, well, the one could make a case, this I've never thought in these terms before, but let me just throw this out, and I'm sure that Dr. Brzezinski would take strong exception to it. But one could make a case that the most successful policies were those initiated by the president in which the Secretary of State and his staff were the primary actors. Camp David was first and foremost built based on extensive work that was done by people in the State Department in close cooperation with advisors in the NSC, but who I never had the impression were working or directly under Spig, although he was involved, but people like Bill Quandt, for example, played a major role, but so was Cy Vance, very heavily involved, Hal Saunders and others in the State Department. The Panama Canal treaty was negotiated by Ellsworth Bunker and Saul Linowitz, and Warren Christopher was the field general that got it through the Senate. Dave Popper working with Warren. The human rights emphasis was the president's, largely implemented by the State Department. The U.S. role in Zimbabwe was a role pursued by Andy Young, Don McHenry, Tony Lake, Dick Moose, and Cy Vance personally. The less successful areas, at least the perception is that the less successful areas were the areas of the direct East-West relationship, and that was the areas in which this division, I wouldn't say that was the area in which the NSC played the major role, but it was an area that was most affected by this division, and therefore in some ways it was the area that in which there were fewer successes.
And
yes.
Just pull it, I need to throw something out and have David comment on it. But my comments referred to before David got back from Manila. But in the early days, let me just cite one, the way one situation played and see how it relates to what you're talking about here. When the two big things that Carter did with regard to the Soviet Union in the first year of his administration were his direct answer to Sakharov's letter, I'll say something about that, and the sort of pushing to the side and out of the path of progress of the strategic arms negotiations talks. Now, this, what happened...
Not so much pushing aside, but revising
I'm going to suggest what I mean by pushing aside. The SALT II had gotten well down the line in the last days of the Ford administration. It had a form, it had a shape, what was remained to be worked out was not very great. The first act that happened affecting this was to dismiss what had happened so far. We were going to start de novo. This was totally offensive to the Russians because Brezhnev was very eminently associated with these previous negotiations, and it was as if saying to him, look, what you've been doing in the last 2 years doesn't really make much difference. We're going to start all this over. We're going to do something bigger. You know, and that's what happened. The way that this was handled created a delay in about 15 months in SALT II. If you take that, push that back from the other end, we would probably have gotten SALT II ratified before all the political events wiped it out. Cyrus Vance was absolutely opposed to this. And he decided that he was not going to really make a confrontation. In the early days, and so far as U.S.-Soviet relations, this Vance's tendency to try to negotiate things out by talking inside of the house instead of confrontation was transferred to the way policy was made, not just to the policy. And he did not take on the White House and or as big on this issue. The other issue was this human rights thing, which related to this letter that Sakharov had written. Sakharov was the symbol of human rights in the Soviet Union. The only thing wrong with the letter that he wrote was that he had a list of so-called prisoners of conscience that were incarcerated in the Soviet Union, which he wanted action to be taken on. Soviet point of view, these people had all been convicted according to Soviet law and put in jail. And for Carter to publicly reply directly to Sakharov was to take on Brezhnev on this issue in front of his own people. We devised a way in which he could reply to Sakharov and have the Carter's reply to Sakharov be a piece of the thing, but that he wouldn't. It didn't get done directly with Carter's name on the paper. It was sort of some laying on of hands here. And how that got okayed in the White House, nobody, as far as I know, concerned to this day, really knows who okayed doing this. And I've talked to Bill Hyland, who was Brzezinski's deputy and a real pro if there ever was one, and Bill didn't know. As far as anybody can find out, Jessica Tupman, Barbara Tupman's daughter, who came in and was the human rights girl on the NSC, was the last name that was put on this particular act before the president himself signed it. Those two things had the effect of the nature of the administration's relations with the Soviet Union for at least the first 15 months of the administration. And on neither of these was Vance willing and ready to take the administration on in front. There was a similar problem, we won't go into the detail, that involved personnel with regard to who was going to be in charge of running the Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, the radio station which had always been under the state. And here again, Kaczynski made a move, and Vance was determined not to raise this differences to the level of confrontation that got out of you. He didn't want Carter to believe that he was trying to push his authority to the point of creating difficulties for him. I don't know whether that characterized his relations later, but that's what set the tone for the first 15 months of the administration.
Are you asking whether Vance rather than David is the wimp? I don't like
in terms of being ready to take on to back Brzezinski off in the early days, that's why I'm specifically relating to the early days of the administration, there's no question that that was so.
What Vance did not like the confrontation, I think one reason that Brzezinski characterized me the way he did is that I was the one who was sent over to NSC meetings representing the State Department often on issues where there was this kind of difference, and I was the one that was presenting the State Department position.
I always thought of you as the opposite whenever I've been in the group. Well, others, Howard.
I wanted to know, from your observation, to what extent was Jimmy Carter influenced by Rosalynn? She, to my memory, is the only wife of a president that sat in the cabinet rooms. Was this resented? Or did she have some influence in making Carter more ambivalent because of her input?
I have, I really never saw that influence demonstrated. It was talked about. Some people said that one of Brzezinski's, his strengths in the White House was his closeness to Rosalynn, that he often would go to her to push a particular point. No doubt, and in the post-presidency period, it's very clear that Carter and Rosalynn see themselves as very, very close together and working together on whatever project he's involved in. So I'm sure they discussed national policy and foreign policy, I don't have any details on how specifics in which she might have had particular influence.
Other questions? Lee Middleditch, Bill Wimple, and Paul David, anybody else?
I have one question, but I'd like to hold it to the end because it's not relevant to the
okay, Ms. Parker. Bill?
You mentioned the saying that cabinet members tend to get captured by their departments. Do you think there's a cure for that? Or that a cure would be necessarily desirable, but the question whether the cabinet member is going to be able to take command and run the department or be more or less run by it. Do you think there is a cure for that?
Definitely there is a cure in the personality of the cabinet officer. But I would draw a distinction between the person who assumes responsibility for a cabinet office without injecting any ideas or authority of his own into the relationship, and the ideal person, and there have been many, is someone who who works well with the bureaucracy in which he or she is responsible for, but is able to adapt the basic thrusts of that bureaucratic element to the priorities and thrusts of the administration. But I think it is important in the working of the policy process that cabinet members do reflect the views and the expertise of the departments that they head in deliberations with the president and with other members of the cabinet on major issues. Otherwise, I think a great deal of expert knowledge and judgment and intuition can be lost to the policy process. I think it's probably too early. I think the clearest example of the well, I think we have two examples in the present administration, perhaps, in that point to opposite ways to deal with the issue. I think Mr. Baker has made it very clear that he does not want to appear in any way to have been captured by the State Department,
even on East Jerusalem.
Even on East Jerusalem. Will history look back and suggest that opportunities were missed or issues were handled in a less desirable way because there was not the kind of upward communication in the State Department which has characterized previous administrations? I don't know. It's, I think the other example is Cheney in defense, who sees his role as, in effect, protecting the Department of Defense from the developments of the day, or perhaps to put it more charitably, ensuring that the changes that have to be made in policy will be done with a minimum of disruption with the in the defense establishment.
Paul David and then Lee Middleditch, and then we should adjourn, I think.
Well, the reference to Rosalynn in the cabinet meeting, reminded me of a question I've had for a long time. I've never seen anything to indicate that she ever did anything except just sit there. Did she ever participate in discussion?
I was never in any meeting at in the cabinet room where she was present. A couple of times when I've been up to Camp David, she's been present at the lunch, but not in the meetings that took place either before or after, and I don't recall her making any substantive contribution at the lunch.
Final question, Lee.
You don't mind taking a question off the topic. I'm interested in what are some of the more significant changes that you've observed in the training of Foreign Service officers during your career, and whether there are changes that you would advocate for the future that might be considered?
My basic problem was the training of Foreign Service officers by the Foreign Service Institute over the years is that there's a much greater emphasis on training bureaucrats than there is on training diplomats. And it's, I think, grown worse in recent years, where there's a heavy emphasis on training Foreign Service officers for management of embassies abroad and management within the department. This view is based on, I guess, at least four experiences. One, for many years when I was in the department, I used to say to the heads of FSI, you don't have a single course that prepares Foreign Service officers to work in Washington. And the answer I would get, which I felt was absurd, was, well, there's no difference in the conduct of foreign relations in Ouagadougou or in Washington. Well, there's a tremendous difference. The second example was when I was working, training new ambassadors coming in, both political and non-political. And the first course that I was presented with was almost entirely on how you got your allowances, how many people you could have on your embassy resident staff, the housekeeping functions of the embassy. And it wasn't particularly for new people that had never been in diplomacy before. There wasn't a single hour in this 3 or 4 day course. I think maybe it's improved since, but there wasn't a single hour which dealt with with what an ambassador does during those first critical days of his or her presence at another post. How do you begin to develop contacts? What do you hope your predecessor has left behind? Do you deal only with the foreign ministry, or do you deal with other ministries as well? Examples of how you approach the head of state, which Washington always assumes you do on every issue. The third was a course that we devised at Georgetown and gave for a couple of years at the Foreign Service Institute on relations with the press, which happens to be another interest of mine. That didn't last because it was just not considered as relevant as some of the other management aspects. And then finally, my impressions of training of Foreign Service officers has been affected by the fact that I've now been at a university teaching international affairs and diplomacy for the last 8 years, and realize how little of The traditional literature and the traditional literature of diplomacy that bears on the practice of the profession, one ever comes in contact with in a normal training course in the Foreign Service Institute. The basic volumes like Satow and Nicholson and de Callier and so on, I'd never heard of. I was not an international relations major until I began teaching at Georgetown. These are things I think that an American diplomat should know, because our foreign counterparts have been brought up in a classical system of education for diplomacy.
Every time I've ever been with David in the group, I've had the feeling, as was said of one former president, when you're in his presence, you sense a mind at work. And today, this morning has been no different. So we're terribly grateful to you, and this does add an important chapter to our Carter oral history. Thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Glad we could work this out. I'm delighted.
Well, I don't know.
Sacrifice. Yeah.